Hello, everyone. Welcome to the UFO Files. I'm Jerry Pippin. On the line from Las Vegas, Nevada, we have a couple of very interesting men. George Knapp, who heads the HIGH team. He's an investigative reporter for KLAS-TV out there, Channel 8, the CBS affiliate. And also we have an interesting fellow who now lives in California, but did live in Las Vegas for several years, Dr. Colm Kellner. And he headed NIDS, the National Institute of Discovery Sciences, at one time. They've written a book, a very interesting read, called Hunt for the Skinwalker. And so let's go ahead and talk to these two. First of all, let's talk to George. George Knapp, Mandalay Bay last night had a very interesting sign. You were there, a star, right there on the Las Vegas Strip. For the book signing last night, I guess we can say you have arrived.
Yeah, that's a kick, isn't it? I think that's the only chance I'm going to get up on a marquee.
So this is kind of a new experience for you, right?
It is a new experience. It's a little bit unsettling, you know. As a journalist, Jerry, you can relate to this. You feel a little bit uncomfortable in going out and hawking some wares, so to speak. But Colm and I, Colm Kelleher and I, are pretty proud of the work that we've done on this book. It's not perfect by any means, but we think we've advanced the cause.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Hunt for the Skinwalker in detail here in a minute, and also maybe you can put Dr. Keller on before it's over as well. This is an interesting avenue. I remember the series you did for KLAS-TV on this. I had no idea you were doing a book.
Well, actually, I had written a couple of articles for a Las Vegas weekly newspaper back at the end of 2002, and the story had really been driving me crazy because Dr. Kelleher and my other friends from NIDS had been pulling me in on this stuff for a number of years with the understanding that I would not be able to make it public in any way until they gave me permission. Well, I kept bugging them for some time, and eventually in the end of 2002, they allowed me to go ahead and proceed with those articles for the primary reason of seeing what kind of a reaction it generated and whether we could get some leads on additional hotspots, paranormal hotspots around the country. And there was so much interest in those two articles that I tried to go back to NIDS and see if we could do some other things. At the time, they weren't interested in that because they were worried about intrusion at the Skinwalker Ranch property by outsiders. Eventually, though, I wore them down, and Colm and I started working on the book.
Yeah, why don't you tell our audience a little bit about this whole situation up there in Utah? It's a pretty far out story, but it's at the same time, as you say, it's one of the better paranormal tales I've heard, and evidently you were there, and you can witness. You waited around there in the chair one time, waiting for this thing, and got a mosquito bite, and that was about it, huh?
Yeah, I'll tell you that story in a second. First, the overview about the ranch. This is a 480-acre picturesque property in northeastern Utah, and it's idyllic. It's a beautiful setting. It looks like a great place to have a ranch, except for its long history of paranormal activity. And in the book, we sort of, it's a, like a laundry list of strange things, strange phenomena, including UFOs of a variety of different kinds, Bigfoot sightings, poltergeist-type activity, cattle mutilations, weird animals, everything you can name all wrapped up in one place. Now, this part of northeastern Utah, the Uinta Basin, has been the site of a phenomenal amount of UFO activity for the past 50, 60 years, and perhaps even longer than that. However, the epicenter of the basin activity seems to be this property. The Ute tribe, which lives just directly adjacent to the property and has been there for hundreds of years, refers to this particular ranch as a place where it's the path of the skinwalker, they call it, meaning that an evil skinwalker, a shape-shifting witch of some sort, lives on that property, and they advise their tribal members to stay away from it as a result.
Now the Indians, they seem to think it was probably a medicine man gone berserk or something.
Well, yeah, like I said, Skinwalker being an evil witch or a shapeshifter, But I think that's sort of the blanket explanation, the umbrella explanation that the tribe has developed over the years for all the strange, the wide variety of strange things that they have seen occur on that particular property. That's sort of their blanket explanation for it. We know it now as a lot of different kinds of paranormal activity. I'm sure that there is enough of different kinds of paranormal activity that we're going to get all kinds of people heat from all sorts of different directions. The ghost people won't like the UFO people, and the UFO people hate the Bigfoot people, and they're not going to be comfortable all being thrown into the same pot. But that just is where the evidence led us.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned that, and over the years, I've come to the conclusion that there might be a connection between Bigfoot legends and UFO legends.
Well, that's sort of where the book heads, is that we look at what the possible explanations that would encompass all this different kind of activity would be. You know, normally, guys like you and I, Jerry, we kick around ideas about UFOs, and we think of extraterrestrials or the traditional space aliens. Really not an explanation that works for all the stuff that we saw here at the ranch. There certainly were UFOs, but we saw no indication that they really came from some other planet. They're definitely alien, but where they're from, we're not sure.
Now, what did you actually see while you were up there? You've been up there several times.
I've been up there four different times. Mostly I went up to tag along with Dr. Kelleher and the other NIDS team members, and to interview them, for them to show me where all the events had occurred, to document what I could, hopefully to go out on these night watches that characterized the works of NIDS up there over several years, and to see what we could see. Now, by the time I got up there, which was my first visit was in 2002, the activity had peaked. In fact, the activity probably peaked in 1997, a couple of years after NIDS had been there. But perhaps you should probably talk to Dr. Kelleher about that.
Yeah, I want to find out, and I will talk to him about maybe his explanation of why it ceased. It's kind of interesting. I want to also find it seems interesting that NIDS would be that involved in it. They bought the property, didn't they?
They sure did. There was a single, the ranch family that had been there for a couple of years, finally out of desperation allowed a news reporter to do a story about it. The story was picked up on Associated Press and made its way here to Las Vegas. So Robert Bigelow, the businessman that's from Las Vegas, saw the story, got his team together, flew up to Utah, met with the rancher, and pretty much on the spot bought the property and moved his team of scientists where they spent the next 7 years studying every inch of the property, running down every lead, investigating every paranormal activity, every cattle mutilation, every incident, interviewing everyone who lived in the area. It's really an unprecedented scientific study because, you know, UFOs, you look at UFOs, they're here 1 minute, they're a light in the sky, and they're gone, and you don't see them in the same area again. This is an area that had multiple kinds of paranormal activity over a long period of time, and it presented a unique opportunity for scientists to do some real hard work. And Mr. Bigelow and NIDS, that's exactly what they did. And for a seven-year period, they, in essence, had a cone of silence over the property and were not releasing information about what they found for some very logical and reasonable reasons, is because they really didn't know what the heck they had.
I remember at one time there was evidently a lot of concern that maybe a lot of people would go up there and disturb whatever was happening. I think you even cautioned it in one of those articles for the weekly newspaper there.
There had been a number of intrusions over the years. I mean, the story about the ranch had gotten out. The real names of the ranch family had gotten out. NIDS was doing its best to try to protect the family from any further intrusions. And in addition, you know, there's really some questions about the interactive nature of this phenomena. Whatever this thing was, it's some kind of an intelligence. It seemed to have an interactive relationship with the people on the ranch and with the researchers, and it seemed to at times anticipate what people on the ranch would do. And so, naturally, a scientist doesn't want intrusions by a lot of uninvited guests who might upset that balance, whatever that balance is, at a time when everyone was working so hard to try to figure out what this thing was. So, yeah, we didn't want a lot of people running around up there. They've still done it to some extent. There are still intrusions here and there over the years. A lot of people who camp out outside of the property to see what they can see. But I think they probably get a little bit tired of it because, A, the activity has decreased so much over the past couple of years, and B, even from the best vantage point, they wouldn't have been able to see the best and most impressive events that happened on the property.
We're talking with George Knapp in Las Vegas, and the name of the book, of course, is a very interesting read, by the way. You need to pick it up, folks, and get it. It's available at most bookstores, by the way, and you can order it just about any place you need to as well. This book, when you authored it, did you and Dr. Keller discuss what you were going to call it? I guess it's pretty obvious that you ended up calling it what you did.
Yeah, I think it sort of grew out of the title of the newspaper articles that came out in 2002. But yeah, literally we're not hunting for a skinwalker, but we're certainly hunting for the same kind of umbrella explanation that the Ute tribe has been seeking.
Yeah, Hunt for the Skinwalker is the name of the book, of course. You talk about people going up there. Have there been reports of people actually getting bodily harm from that area?
Well, I'll answer that in a couple of ways. Number one is that there is certainly a psychological harm of a severe nature on the family. We call them the Gormans. I mean, this family was devastated by what they went through over a 20-month period living on the property. I mean, just totally, the kids who were straight-A students, their grades went right down down the tubes. The wife lost her job. By the end of their ordeal there, all four family members were sleeping in the same room on the floor at night just for comfort and mutual security. Physically harmed, only a couple of marks on their bodies. However, there were very dangerous situations that were created by the phenomenon on the ranch. There were a couple of instances where these flying objects, balls of light, would frighten the animals, the horses that the rancher would be riding on, scattered the cattle and drove them off a cliff almost. If the rancher hadn't jumped off his horse, he would have gone over the cliff and gone through some serious bodily harm. But I think Colum is the best guy to answer some of those parts of the question.
Yeah, and I'll get to him here in just a second. I want to ask you one other thing before I talk to him. And the first time you went up there, this is pretty remote, right?
Yes.
What was your impression? You probably I had a little skepticism. Inquisitive, well, let me see for myself.
Well, exactly, and I never actually saw any of this stuff for myself, but I know NIDS, I know the people, I know Colum, and I trust their judgment, and I've been reading these reports on a regular basis for a long time. These are serious guys. They're not making this stuff up, and they had done a really great job of documenting the whole history of the area by speaking to so many different kinds of people from different walks of life, the Ute tribes, lawmen, professionals in the town, neighbors, ranchers, all kinds of people, all of whom backed up the idea that something really, really strange had been going on for a very long time. So I was pretty convinced that what the NIDS guys were investigating was legitimate. I would have to say there was a certain amount of anxiety on my part going up there, because some of the stories that you'll hear are pretty damn frightening. But actually, when I got onto the property, it's a strange thing, but it was really a calming kind of a feeling. I mean, a feeling of serenity, and I've had it every time I've been to the property since.
Interesting. Before I get Dr. Keller on, you've got to tell me that story. Why did they tie you up in the chair? What was the deal?
That's Colum's little joke on me, you know. I guess for a time, there would be certain types of things that would happen at the ranch that would stimulate paranormal activity. One of them would be digging into the ground. Another would be the arrival of newcomers, making a bunch of noise. And so on my first or second visit up there, Colum decided, well, he thought maybe I had a certain inherent weirdness quotient that might attract something by the end of the year or whatever this energy is on the property. So we dug in the ground, we got an earth mover, made a bunch of noise, dug some holes, we built a fire out on the range and made a bunch of noise and made a test of ourselves, and then they put me out on this chair and put in this field where some very bad things had happened before and left me there in the middle of the night and wanted to see if something came to get me.
What time of the night was it?
I don't know, 10, 11 o'clock.
Pretty dark out there, huh?
And they all went off a couple hundred yards and kind of kept an eye on me, and I can hear them having a couple of beers and a good time somewhere where I'm out there and dangling as bait. Now, I'm just kidding, sort of, but
yeah.
I'm there for about 45 minutes. Nothing happened to me other than some mosquito bites, but I will admit to you that there were some tense moments waiting for something to come out of the bushes.
Sure. Sure, I don't care how, you know, brave you think you are. You do think of the possibilities.
I certainly did that night.
And maybe the reason nothing showed up is they knew the people were not very far from you.
That could be. I mean, this entity, as Tom will tell you, it seems to be able to read minds and anticipate actions and some of the games that it played with the surveillance equipment that was up there, it will just blow you away.
Okay, let's go ahead and talk to Dr. Kelleher here, and I'll come back to you before we wrap up the show. It's interesting, this whole situation. Dr. Kelleher, how are you?
Good, very good.
Good. I want to ask you, how did NIDS get involved in that? NIDS, I guess, stands for what, National Institute of Discovery Sciences?
Yeah, National Institute for Discovery Science was founded by Robert Bigelow in 1995. And the purpose for NIDS was to bring together a bunch of mainstream scientists who had really no axe to grind except to get to the truth in terms of researching these phenomena. Now, Robert Bigelow also brought together what we still consider a world-class science advisory board, who are made up of physicians and physicists, people who are expert in medicine, psychology, chemistry, biology, you name it. So the purpose for NIDS was to investigate what was going on at the ranch, and the scientific advisory board really held our feet to the fire in terms of making sure that the scientific method was rigorously adhered to.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing that I think of you in terms of cancer research.
Well, I do have a background in cancer
yes.
research. I've worked a lot in molecular biology and biochemistry, yes.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, and so, and then here you are. Did you actually move to Las Vegas for a while?
Yes, I moved actually to Las Vegas for 8 years. I moved to take the job at the National Institute for Discovery Science because in one of the mainstream science magazines, there was this bizarre ad, at least I thought it was pretty bizarre, looking for scientists that were willing to explore the origin and evolution of consciousness in the universe. I mean, how many times do you see that in a mainstream science journal?
Yeah, right. I can understand. I can understand. I can understand how that would get to your interest completely. How did you get involved with this Utah ranch and this legend? I mean,
as George mentioned, the ranching family were so traumatized and basically beaten into the ground, both physically and financially and psychologically, that eventually they began to talk to people with a view to getting some help for their predicament, because they were basically financially ruined by this whole episode. They lost 15 of their best animals in a period of 20 months, which basically put them out of business. So they were looking for help. So.
Now, all of those animals, were they mutilated?
They were both mutilated and disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
Some pretty spectacular mutilations on the property. Even after NIDS group moved onto the property, Robert Bigelow heard about this story, bought the property, set it up as a laboratory for the paranormal out in the country, put in a lot of equipment, and then installed a bunch of scientists to look at that, and all of the scientists had basically a bunch of portable equipment to go into the middle of this remote ranch with magnetic field detectors, electric field detectors. We had alpha, beta, gamma, and X-ray detectors. We had portable spectrometers. We had video cameras. We had infrared equipment. I mean, we had the works, and we had all of this portable stuff. So we could move around at will, and the purpose of the exercise was to measure whatever we could measure. And that's certainly one way of addressing this whole thing.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but on the cattle mutilations, were you able to determine Were there similar circumstances when they would occur? Or, I mean, you were measuring everything there. Was there any anomalies or something jumped up that caught your attention?
There were a couple of different, very spectacular mutilations on the property. I'll give you an example of one.
Okay.
It did have some curious properties. The rancher and his wife, this was in March of 1997, had just finished tagging this 84-pound calf that had been born in the middle of the night, and they moved about 300 yards down the way to tag another calf when the dog that was with them began to act strangely. So they turned around, and this was 10 o'clock in the morning at this stage, they turned around to see what the dog was acting up about, and they saw that the cow who had given birth to this calf was also acting strangely. So they ran back to check things out, and they found that the calf that they had just tagged had been completely stripped. All of the internal organs were gone. The rib cage was broken open. There was not a single drop of blood on the animal or in the animal, and this was in broad daylight over a 45-minute period with two eyewitnesses only 300 yards away.
And they saw nothing.
They saw absolutely nothing. Now, obviously, a frantic phone call was made to NID's headquarters in Las Vegas. We took a private jet to that place, and we were standing over that animal 5 hours later. And the first thing that was really obvious to me was that a sharp instrument had been used to cut off the ear that held the bright yellow ear tag, and also the fact that there wasn't a single drop of blood on that animal. So, or underneath the animal, we went through a lot of we jumped through a lot of hoops to make sure there was no dry blood on that grass, or blood had not seeped into the soil.
So it was.
The bottom line was we had forensic analysis conducted on that animal, and we showed that there were two separate sharp instruments used to kill that animal. One was a heavy machete-like instrument, and the other one was like a scissors, a more delicate scissors-type instrument. Now, the thing is, these instruments were used on that animal in broad daylight with a couple of eyewitnesses just down the way, and nothing was seen or nothing was heard. So that kind of mutilation I would rate as being different in general in MO than most of the mutilations that I personally investigated.
Now, most of them, I guess, involve a light or something coming down, and the cow dropped down or something, left alone or something. I mean, what's a normal cattle mutilation like?
A normal cattle mutilation is when either one of the eyes, one of the ears, the tongue, the rectum, or the reproductive organs are removed with surgical precision. I have never, in all of the mutilation cases I've ever investigated, never seen any evidence for the quote-unquote high heat or cautery that's alleged in cattle mutilation.
Uh-huh. So
never seen any evidence of anything except extremely skilled surgery on these animals.
So
doing this knows exactly what organs they want to take, and they have a good background in surgery. Sharp instruments are used, obviously, and you can easily tell the difference in a forensic way between sharp instruments and, cutting and tearing that predators usually use. So we were easily able to nail the real mutilations and distinguish them from the predator attack.
Yeah, literally they were using surgical instruments of some sort rather than lasers, you think?
That's what we think, yeah.
Yeah.
We think looking under a low-power microscope, if you look at the edges, it's obvious that a sharp instrument was used as distinct from a laser, because a laser would involve cautery and would involve, you could actually see, in some cases, there's a photograph on the NIDS website that still exists, that one of these animals where there was an inch diameter cut around the eye, and you can actually see the way the hair was cut. So this was a sharp instrument. It was not, we didn't think there was any evidence for lasers.
You mentioned the NIDS website, and it's no longer active. Why did NIDS close?
Well, NIDS didn't really close. It was more put on ice because the main scientific staff left to seek other jobs, basically. And there were three of the main scientific staff over a period of about a year, year and a half, left to take up other positions. So I would not say that NIDS is closed. I would say NIDS is on ice.
Okay.
Could be reactivated at any moment.
Well, I appreciate you.
A lot of this does pertain to the Utah Ranch.
Right.
And there is ongoing activity at the Utah Ranch. So if ever there was a need to reinvestigate that, NIDS would be reactivated.
Now, I appreciate you making that clarification. You no longer live in Las Vegas. Where are you?
I'm in Northern California, just outside San Francisco.
Okay.
I work in the biotechnology field now. I do research on viruses.
Interesting. But you would probably come back and at least help on a consulting basis with NIDS if they got activated again, probably.
I would definitely be very interested in keeping my hand in. I mean, what I really enjoyed about NIDS on the Utah Ranch was that it was an attempt at being extremely rigorous, employing what we thought was the best available equipment, and it was an unusual project in that funding was not a problem. There was never any questions about money. Funding was no problem for this kind of research, and at the same time, we had the ability to go to the Science Advisory Board, many of which worked at government labs, university labs around the country, and basically get the best possible cutting-edge equipment if we ever needed to go down a particular research road. So we were able to do the kinds of forensic analysis that only the FBI can do.
Now, when did you decide to write this book? I mean, you and George, was that kind of an afterthought, or did you guys think, hey, this is just, we need to get the story out? I mean, what was the motive there?
Well, I think, as George mentioned, George was the main impetus in wanting the book to take form, because when he first approached us, we were still in the middle of the research project, but as the project wound down, it did occur to both of us that to put this kind of information out as a stimulus to people who may be interested in investigating these kinds of phenomena, and I'm speaking for my part mostly about scientists, I think there's a real need for the scientific community to begin to get its teeth into these kinds of phenomena, because otherwise there's going to be this long, long period of inactivity where there's nothing really done. I mean, a lot of people are interested in these phenomena, but we really need research funding. We really need research expertise in order to get things done.
Now, I know you're a scientist and probably don't like questions like this, but what do you think's going on up there?
Well, from what I saw personally and from the major, the multiple interviews that we did up on the Utah Ranch, I think there's no doubt that there's a phenomenon up there. It may be more than one. It certainly manifests in many different ways. It does exhibit some kind of an intelligence. In other words, it is very conscious of being hunted as opposed to being the hunter. In other words, when NIDS arrived on the property, there was a pretty dramatic transformation from a family that was basically being terrorized into submission to a whole bunch of scientists on the property with a lot of expensive equipment. So the hunter became the hunted. So I think there was a definite psychological shift on that ranch when NIDS took over. So I think there were consequences to that, that the phenomenon became more evasive, and our investigations really involved kind of like a cat and mouse game of tracking these really transient phenomena, including creatures, including these orbs of light. There were whole different kinds of multiple phenomena that happened over a period of time after we moved onto the ranch. We were tracking these things every night, and they inevitably left very few fingerprints or footprints.
You know, are we talking about one entity that maybe have many parameters, or are we talking about different entities, or do you know? Do you have an idea?
We don't have enough information to even distinguish between those two. This could be a grand central station where multiple different phenomena intersect at some kind of point for some unknown reason, or else it could be a single phenomenon that's manifesting in many different ways. Or else it could be some kind of a dimensional phenomenon where there's a, you know, to use a crude expression, there's some kind of a hole in the sky where things come through. And the reason I mention that is that the previous rancher who owned the property on many different occasions remarked about this large hole in the sky that used to open over the ranch, and he actually used a telescope to watch stuff coming from the other side all the way through. I mean, he saw these flying objects that were triangular shaped coming through this hole in the sky. He could actually see a different colored sky on the other side. So that's why I used the analogy of a kind of a dimensional.
Yeah, we've talked about portals over the years with UFO and paranormal shows. You might actually have one there, huh?
Well, it certainly, from the rancher's description, I never saw any of those personally, but there were certainly a lot of different phenomena that happened that were very difficult to explain, except for some kind of a dimensional effect. You know, there were so many animal disappearances, too, that were very difficult to explain. We had, for example, 4 prize bulls on the ranch at one stage. They were in this corral, and the rancher and his wife went down to the other end of the property. They were talking about how valuable these animals were. When they arrived back, they found the corral empty, and they said, "Oh my God, our livelihood is ruined." They searched around the corral for a while, and then one of the rancher walked over to this very small white trailer that was at the end of the corral, and lo and behold, all 4 animals, huge 2,200-pound bulls, were packed into this white trailer, and there's really no way they could have got in there because there was no exit. So what could have lifted 4 extremely aggressive 2,200-pound bulls and put them into this narrow confine? The rancher went over, and he was so startled that to see his animals in this narrow, confined space that he banged on the sides of the thing, and it seemed like that banging actually triggered a release from some sort of a sleep. The animals appeared to be sort of sleepwalking. They were stunned, and they went crazy when they realized where they were, so they kicked the doors of this trailer down. So one of the things that we noticed when we arrived on the property was that the whole area was extremely strongly magnetized. All of the bars of the corral had a strong magnetic signature, and that faded over a 36-hour period. So whatever was involved in this, we think, might be associated with some kind of strong magnetic field.
Yeah, evidently there were UFOs floating around, not only with the family that you write about in the book, but the previous owners as well. There were 3 dogs that were killed in a gruesome fashion. Was that more or less like the cattle mutilations, or what?
Well, it was much more graphic, I think, because the rancher actually saw who the perpetrators were in that case.
Oh, who were they?
He saw a basketball-sized blue orb that was very, very common on the ranch. He saw it coming low in across the field when he was sitting outside his house one evening, and his 3 dogs were by his side. The blue orb kind of moved around the field, and the dogs got very excited by it. So these were extremely aggressive blue heelers that were very good cattle dogs. So the rancher set his dogs on this thing to see what would happen. And this object, every time the dogs lunged at it, just dodged out of the way effortlessly, so it was obviously under intelligent control. So it began to sort of dance in front of the dog's jaws and lead them down towards this copse of trees, and the rancher was watching this as it unfolded. So the blue orb led the 3 dogs into this copse. The next thing the rancher heard were these agonized yelps of the dogs in mortal agony. Then it was silent, and he was too scared to go down there to investigate immediately. So the next day he went down, and he saw 3 rings of burnt grass down there, and in the middle of those rings were these greasy, black, oily substances. Obviously, he put the 2 and 2 together and said that the blue orb had actually incinerated his 3 favorite dogs, and that was actually the turning point for the decision to move off the ranch with the family in general. That happened in mid-1996.
So they literally were burned alive, probably.
They yelped in mortal agony.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an extremely aggressive demonstration to animals, and you know, there were several others, you know, effects on animals too, but the killing of his dogs really had a big effect on the rancher.
Well, I can certainly understand that. I'm a dog man too, but you know, all of these things, especially the cattle mutilations and the lack of blood, seems to me there must be something going on there, akin to a vampire legend almost.
Well, you know, even a vampire kind of, when they slit a vein or an artery, some blood just spills. When I looked down at that carcass, it was perfectly pink. And you know, what really struck me was that it was a combination of extreme force that had been used to pull the ball and socket joints of the animal's hips and legs apart, and at the same time had laid the animal down carefully on the grass with all four legs, you know, perfectly spread eagles. It was like a combination of extreme force and very, very delicate, you know,
surgery, right?
Very chilling to see that. And at the same time, the idea that not a single drop of blood was found in or on that animal. It's very difficult to kill an animal. Even an 84-pound animal has between 2 and 3 liters of blood. You know, that's a lot of blood. So not to have a single drop of blood on the animal was pretty astounding. And then the subsequent forensic analysis that yielded, evidence of sharp instruments, we went through many, many, many gaming exercises to see if humans could possibly have done this or who could have possibly done that. Maybe the animal was taken elsewhere, killed, all of the internal organs removed, all of the blood sucked away, brought back, and then put down on the grass in a 45-minute span. But what could have done that, or who could have done that?
And it would be pretty hard to do that without anyone noticing.
Exactly, especially with two people just down the way.
And
there was that element of the undercurrent on the ranch was always that element of, I would say that was a hostile act. So there was that undercurrent of hostility that was running through a lot of the events on the ranch. On another occasion, we set up 6 independent surveillance cameras to watch a particular hotspot of activity, because we thought that if we had cameras running 7/24, that we could at least capture some of these phenomena on camera. And 3 of the cameras were absolutely ruthlessly destroyed one day. All of them lost power at the same time. The wiring was forcibly ripped out of the casings. The PVC tubing that anchored the wiring to the camera pole was ripped off. I mean, it was a very violent maneuver. And there was a camera elsewhere that was pointing directly at the pole where all the 3 damaged cameras were. So we ran back, got the tape, played it to see who the perpetrators were, and this was just in the evening, but there was enough daylight to see there was nobody there at all. We could actually, when we enhanced the videotape, we could see that the lights of the camera, we saw the lights of the camera going off. It coincided exactly with the timestamp shutting down, but at the same time there was nothing, no evidence whatsoever about what or who had destroyed those cameras. So there was those kinds of, if you want to take a hint, you know, that's a pretty good hint to stop using cameras on the property.
It seems to me that whatever this was did not like to be investigated. As you said, the hunter became the hunted. Is that the reason everything has kind of ceased as far as the activity, you think?
I think the first year that Niz was on the property, I think there was a whole spate of different incidents, and they're all described in the book. And they culminated in some spectacular stuff that happened in August of 1997. After that, things began to slow down. The cameras were destroyed in July of 1998, which is, you know, almost a year later. But, you know, I think at that stage the activity, whatever it was, had begun to die down. Now, whether or not this quote-unquote phenomenon had begun to lose interest or whatever, but there was a period initially after Nids moved onto the property where every time we were on the property, there was something bizarre happening on the property. So it was a very intense time, and then gradually over time, it became less intense.
And you really don't have any kind of clue other than maybe it's a Grand Central Station of all kinds of entities, a gathering place.
The only evidence that we really picked up was there were close to 100 different incidents of account what the rancher experienced and what NIS, the NIS researchers experienced. None of those 100 incidents are particularly alike. There are some commonalities among those 100 incidents. For example, some of the stuff was happening in the infrared region of the spectrum as opposed to the visible region of the spectrum. Some of these were associated with magnetic field signatures. So there were definite patterns like that, but beyond, you know, this sort of phenomenology of this of the whole thing, we were not able to nail down exactly what was happening there.
But you'd also notice, Jerry, that there were a lot of things that would be characterized as like almost a, what we call a poltergeist kind of activity that happened to the ranch family almost from the first day they were there. Things like the you know, the wife would go to town and get 3 weeks' worth of groceries. She comes back home, takes the bags in the kitchen, unloads all the groceries, puts them in the pantry, goes to the bathroom, comes back, all the groceries are back in the bags on the table. Or the rancher was out using a post hole digger. He stops working on the property for a second, wipes his brow, takes a drink of water, turns around, the post hole digger is gone. And they find it days later 75 feet up in a tree. Those kinds of activities happen all the time, and in some ways they're almost the most frightening and unsettling of all. They would hear disembodied voices speaking in strange languages above their head, seemingly mocking them. I mean, it terrified them. We categorized that as more closer to poltergeist than aliens or interdimensionals, but there it was, all mixed in one big bag.
Yeah, you know, that it's just an incredibly strange and scary story. I'm surprised the family stayed as long as they did.
Well, a lot of people ask us that question, why they stayed so long, and it's Column knows the man who we call Tom Gorman, knew him really well, and he was just a kind of a stubborn guy who wanted to get to the bottom of it. For a long time, I think he felt that he suspected that it was the government, the military, pulling some kind of a psychological exercise or some kind of trick or trying to take his property. And he wasn't going to let it happen without a fight. So he would go out each night and hide in behind rocks and in gullies and try to basically sneak up on the phenomena, whatever it was, or to catch these, what he thought were military agents, catch them in the act. And then that's obviously not what happened.
Now, in the opening chapter of this book, there's an interesting paranormal experience, an encounter with a wolf. And this wolf wouldn't die.
That was really the Gorman family's introduction to what was to become a whole series of really bizarre incidents. They were just unloading their furniture. They had arrived that day. They had put a couple of their prized calves in the corral. They had arrived that day. They were unloading furniture. They saw an animal at the distance that, even by any standards, was huge. And it was trotting in their direction. And the closer it got, the bigger it got. And they realized that it was a wolf heading in their direction. But it was not like your ordinary wolf. And remember, this was in Utah in 1994. So this was a long, long time before any wolves were introduced into Wyoming or any of the locations.
Mm-hmm.
The animal trotted all the way up to them. And it came up to, this rancher is 6 feet tall. It came up to his chest. It was a huge wolf that was completely tame and very, very at ease in their presence. So it walked around them and then casually bounded over to the corral, grabbed a calf that was curious looking through the corral, grabbed its head and its jaws, and started to try to drag the calf through the corral. The rancher, of course, reacted immediately and got a large stick, baseball bat, and started hammering on the dog as hard as he could, to no avail, or on the wolf, to no avail whatsoever. So he grabbed his Colt 44 Magnum and pumped two bullets into the animal. That had no effect either.
Wow.
The animal began to let go, but it was still really hanging on. So he told the son to go into his house, grab a 30-06, and come out. This is a hunting rifle that would bring down an elk from 100 yards. So from point-blank range, he put one of these bullets into the wolf, and at that stage, the wolf began to back off, showing no signs of injury, didn't make any sounds, just looked, kind of gauging the situation, and then looked back at the calf to see if he was going to take another lunge at it. The rancher was getting really, really freaked out at this stage, so he put another hunting bullet into the animal, and this time the animal did flinch, but never actually whined or showed no other sign of injury, but backed off a little bit, so it was 30 feet away now, and then finally the rancher put a third 30-06 bullet into the animal, saw a piece of flesh flying off. At that stage, the wolf just turned around and casually trotted away from them.
It made no noise of pain, huh?
The family was totally stunned. I mean, this, the combination of the five bullets would have brought down practically an elephant. And this wolf was unconcerned. It trotted away at sort of half speed. The rancher and his boy took off after it to see where it was going to go. And it disappeared into a thicket and then reemerged near a stream. They followed and broke out into that a level area near the stream and found that the tracks that the animal had left stopped suddenly in thick mud. And, they saw them occasionally in the distance. And then, a few weeks later, they vanished and never saw them again. But that was the opening strange encounter that this family, who were just barely moving out of the property, they were trying to get away from it all, you know, the sort of small-town gossip, and they were getting away to a really pristine location when they encountered this really weird situation.
So it was not always the same wolf, but they were all big wolves?
Yeah, they were wolves maybe three or four times the size of normal wolves, and they didn't have any fear of humans. The nearest approximation is the an extinct wolf called a dire wolf, which went extinct about 15 million years ago. That was a huge animal, you know, measuring sort of 300 pounds, and there's no obviously equivalent alive today. But the kinds of wolves that this animal family encountered were those kinds of dire wolves.
One other note on this wolf story, Jerry, is that when the family came back, the rancher came back and picked up the piece of flesh that had flown off the wolf after he had shot it the last time, the flesh appeared rotten, as if it had been laying out on the pasture in the sun for a couple of weeks.
Wow, incredible. Well, we're going to wrap this up here in a minute. We could talk about this for hours. They need to pick up the book. They can get it at any bookstore. You fellows going to write another book?
That's a good question. The Hunt of the Skinwalker has only been out for two or three days, so we had a good response last night. We hope that people in your neck of the woods and your audience will give it a shot, because there's a lot more to tell about this story. If somebody wants to check it out, huntfortheskinwalker.com.
Yeah, which is interesting. We do have a link to that website as well. George, it's always a pleasure. And Dr. Keller, it's been great talking to you. I've heard a lot about you over the years. Finally get to speak to you.
Thanks, Jerry, for having us on. And maybe we'll come back and visit you and talk about some other things sometime.
Oh, well, we definitely will. if you're willing, we certainly are. We'll be back out in your part of the country in January and February, and we'll be looking you up.
Okay.
We got a lot of other things to talk about. Your TV series is, I like what KLIS TV's done with that Area 51 thing, kind of put them all together, those stories.
Well, I think that's a great idea. I think I produced a two-hour show about Area 51 some 16 years ago and sort of put it on the map, but there's a lot of stuff that's happened in the interim.
Oh, I remember when you did that. I was out at working in Las Vegas and talk radio at the old KVEG, which is now KXNT.
That's right.
And, you know, you really brought some things to forefront, George, that no other mainstream journalist has done. And I really think you need a pat on the back for that. I mean, I know you've had your share of grief over it, probably.
Well, yeah, it's mostly the grief comes from my journalism colleagues. It just sort of drives them up the wall that I would take this stuff seriously. And they point to 1989, when I started doing the UFO stuff, as the year I went crazy, when, as I see it, just as the opposite. I see it as I approach this material the same way I approach any other story. And the question is, why aren't more people taking a look at it? Because the kinds of questions that Colm and I are looking at in this book are the most important questions for facing humanity, the most important questions for all of us in our lives.
And they are the things that legends have been made of, and they're happening today, and they do need to be investigated. Dr. Kellner, same with you. You know, you're a mainstream scientist. I'm glad to see you're interested in this subject.
Well, you know, my interest goes a long time back, and I think I agree with George. You know, there's two types of scientists. The way I would look at it is a normal scientist and a revolutionary scientist. And you know, there are topics that are obviously of great importance to look into, and I've always felt that science really needs to get involved in this area because it is inherent in the discovery process. It's a way, studying anomalies is really a shortcut to the discovery process. And out of the discovery process come new views of reality. So it is, I think it's really important for science to take up the baton. And I think that's one of the main reasons that this book was written.
How much bigger a question can there be than what is the nature of reality and what is our place in it? What is our place in the universe? Where do we come from? Are we alone? Those are big questions that I can't believe that other scientists and other journalists would not be interested in pursuing.
Well, a good point and good way to close the show. The name of the book is Hunt for the Skinwalker. You have a mainstream publisher with a good imprint for that, so you have good distribution so people can pick it up at their latest. They can order it at their bookstore if it's not there, and certainly go to your website. And that, what is, huntfortheskinwalker.com?
That's right.
Thanks a lot, both of you.
Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you very much.
Okay, it's been an interesting hour. Good night.
Good night.